නමෝ තස්සේ භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්සේ නමෝ තස්සේ භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්සේ නමෝ තස්සේ භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්සේ. So we were discussing Madhupindika Sutta translated as the honey ball, and we can actually add few words to that sutta. We have already discussed the important aspects of the sutta, basically how Buddha met Dandapani Sakyan, and then he given a kind of a brief explanation, and Dandapani Sakyan couldn't understand it and he simply went away. And then Buddha came back to the monastery, and there again he explained that statement to the monks, and the monks also didn't understand and they asked for a better explanation. And then Buddha gave another explanation and went back to his dwelling place. So both explanations were not that easy to understand. So the monks went to Venerable Mahakacchana to get a better explanation, to detailed explanation. And then Venerable Mahakacchana is the one given the complete explanation, we can say as the complete genesis of this conceptual proliferation. Depending on the eye and forms, eye consciousness arise. The meeting of the three is contact. With contact as condition, there is feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. With what one has mentally proliferated as the source, perceptions and notions, mental proliferations beset a man with respect to past, future, and present forms cognizable through the eye. So the statement here, what I have mentioned, is related to the eye. So similarly, Venerable Mahakacchana explained towards the ear, nose, tongue, body, and the mind. So, as the first part, it is happening like a causal reaction when the eye and the form meets, when they come in line, then the eye consciousness arise, and this process happens again and again. So when it is happening repeatedly, so the notion of contact comes because these three appear to be available for a long time. Then the contact happens, and this contact causes vedana, the feeling. So far the whole process happened as a cause and effect relationship. After that, so now what one has felt, now one wants to recognize, one want to perceive. So as a result of that, the perception, the recognition happens, and once the recognition happens, so he wants to further elaborate it, further know it, and further want to recognize it. So he is paying more attention and finding out even the subtle details, and then he start to think about it. And now thinking starts. Now he is thinking in one way, he is thinking in another way. Now the thinking happens under his own ambition, under his own control it is happening. Now this is the second stage. Now a person interferes to the process, and then he start deliberately, intentionally thinking. And once the thinking started and it has caught momentum for some time, and then what happens is this thinking process going on and on, and it went on to various directions, which is very much like beyond control, and it is using various conditioning, preconceived ideas, various kind of cultural upbringing, various biases, personality traits. All these things come together and they are influencing the whole process, and ultimately the mental proliferation or conceptual proliferation happen. And that basically beset that particular person, to that very person. So ultimately this the third stage shows that how mental proliferation take the upper hand, and the very person become a victim, a slave to that very thinking, mental proliferation. So this is quite interesting, because this is what normally happens to us, because we also are subjected to this kind of a process. When we feel something, we start to recognize it and we start to think about it. And ultimately, we can't control this thinking, and the thinking overwhelms us. So, this can happen pertaining to the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. So, everywhere this can happen. Interestingly, when one starts, it may sort of associate with the others as well. Say, for example, if one starts with the eye, so it may quickly get on to the mind. So eye is the one triggering the whole process, but ultimately mind get involved, and mentally we reflect about the past to the future, and various other things are happening. So at the same time, probably we may go and touch it, want to touch it, and then the body also getting started. So likewise, all the six faculties start to participate in this whole process. At least a couple of them start to participate in this process. So ultimately, it is very difficult to recognize from where it has began. So that is another thing. So after given this explanation, Venerable Mahakachana further elaborates that when there is eye and form, then it is possible to mention or to point out the manifestation of contact. When there is contact, it is possible to point out the manifestation of feeling. When there is feeling, it is possible to point out the manifestation of perception. So likewise, he beautifully explained further about this whole process as a kind of a conditioned process, kind of a causal reaction. Now, this is very much like the dependent co-arising or dependent origination, where one conditions another. Imasmin sati idam hoti, imasuppada idam uppajjati. Because of this, that arises. With the arising of this, that arises. So basically, there is this principle, Patissamuppada principle. Sometimes we call it as the idappacceta. So that principle is the most important part in the Patissamuppada. So all other information like avijja paccaya sankhara, sankhara paccaya vijnanam, those are basically the examples how this principle actually works. Because of ignorance, the formations arise. Because of formations, then the consciousness, the conditioned consciousness arise. So likewise, so we can apply this principle to any couple of those factors, those links. So similarly here also, when there is eye and the form, the eye consciousness arise. When these three are available, then the contact arise. When contact is there, the feeling arise. When feeling is there, the recognition, the perception arise. When perception is there, the thinking arise. When thinking is there, the mental proliferation arise. So likewise, there's a beautiful causal reaction. On the other hand, when there is no such process, if you are able to avoid such process, then there is no possibility of the other factors or other links to arise. Say, for example, if there is no eye, there is no form, then there is no eye consciousness. When there is no all of those, then there is not possible to arise the contact. When there is no contact, the feeling is not there. When there is no feeling, there is no perception. When there is no perception, there is no thinking. When there is no thinking, there is no mental proliferation. So likewise, one can understand, so somewhere we have to attack the process. Somewhere we have to calm down the process, weaken the process. So that's why in the Vipassana, in the mindfulness practice, we are trying to cut off this mental proliferation time to time so that it may get weakened. And so basically, when this is said, so those monks were quite happy and they went back to the Buddha, and then they explained everything back to the Buddha, that they didn't understand the Buddha's statement, and then they went to Venerable Mahakachana, and he has given this explanation. And Buddha actually rejoice in the statement, the explanation given by Mahakachana, and he said that the Venerable Mahakachana is having a great wisdom, and he know how to explain this kind of deep dhamma, and therefore he accept and approve what Venerable Mahakachana has preached. So it has now become a preaching of the Buddha, because he has given his approval. And he actually praised Venerable Mahakachana for his interesting explanation. Now, Venerable Ananda was there, and he understood the value of this sutta, because it is very much like explaining the very genesis of this conceptual proliferation, which is happening to everyone. So therefore, he found this sutta is interesting and quite interesting. So then he say, Venerable Sir, just as if a man exhausted by hunger and weakens came upon a honey ball. Whenever he would taste it, he would find it a sweet, delectable flavor. So too, Venerable Sir, any able-minded bhikkhu, whenever he might scrutinize with wisdom the meaning of this discourse on the Dhamma, would find satisfaction and confidence in of mind. Venerable Sir, what is the name of this discourse on the Dhamma? As to that, Ananda, you may remember this discourse on the Dhamma as the honey ball discourse, the Madhupindika Sutta. So Venerable Ananda make a comment that this discourse is so interesting, if one wisely reflect in many different angles of this sutta, he getting real Dhamma piti, or what we can call as kind of a dhammic satisfaction, happiness, because it's so profound, so interesting, and giving us a real explanation about this whole thinking process. So therefore, Venerable Ananda mentioned with a simile that it is very much like a hungry person searching of some food, finding a honey ball, and he tastes it. He is delighted in that taste. So then Buddha make the comment, okay, then let's name this sutta as Honey Ball Sutta or the Madhupindika Sutta. So having known this information, I thought of linking this sutta to another sutta, which is actually the last sutta of Majjhima Nikaya. Because Honeyball Sutta, Madhupindika Sutta, actually gave us how this whole mental proliferation starts and how it is going on. And again, Buddha explained very beautifully that if one is not getting victimized to this process, if one is not getting delighted in this mental proliferation, then he is able to overcome or to fade away all different kinds of latent tendencies. Aganusaya, dosanusaya, patigahanusaya, avijjanusaya. So likewise Buddha explained. So different types of various anusaya, latent tendencies, start to fade away because one is not conceptually proliferate. One is not interested in conceptual proliferation. It may happen, but he is not encouraging it. He is not delighted in it. So typical approach, the typical habit of any human being is to think, again and again think. So this thinking going on, and ultimately he become a victim of that whole process, and he delighted in it. So that's why Buddha mentioned, papancha birata paja, nippapancha tathagata. These people, these folk, are delighted in thinking, mental proliferation. But on the other hand, Tathagatas, the Buddhas, are Nippapancha. They are free from mental proliferation. So that is very interesting statement which Buddha mentioned in the Dhammapada, where the typical folk is quite delighted in thinking, but on the other hand, Buddhas are delighted in calming down, the silence. So, how to calm down the mind? So, what are the available methods, strategies to use? So, that actually we can come in many different places. So those strategies are explained by the Buddha. And I thought of starting Indriya Bhavana Sutta, which actually can directly link with Madhupindika Sutta. Because Madhupindika Sutta explained the genesis of this mental proliferation, and Buddha made an interesting, strong statement telling that if one is capable of avoiding such proliferation, there are huge benefits. And so we have to know, so what are the various methods available in this calming down of mental proliferation. Now, in Indriya Bhavana Sutta, this is also a very interesting sutta. This is the last sutta of Majjhima Nikaya. How to develop one's faculties. Now, on one occasion, Buddha was living at Kajangala Grove. Kajangala Grove. So this is a kind of a forest name. And at that time, there is one Brahmin youth. He's called Uttara. Uttara. And he's a pupil of Brahmin Parasariya. So Parasariya is a well-known teacher. So this Uttara, the young Uttara, is a student of Venerable Brahmin Parasariya. So he actually come to visit Buddha, and he exchanged the typical cordial greetings. And after that, Buddha made a question to this Uttara, and Buddha asked, Uttara, does the Brahmin Parasariya teach his disciples the development of the faculties? Now Buddha is taking a kind of a topic here, and he asked from Uttara, is your teacher, Parasariya, is proclaiming any kind of development of faculties? And then Uttara replies, telling that yes, he does. And how he does? Do not see forms with the eye. Do not hear sounds with the ear. This is how the Brahmin Parasariya teaches his disciple the development of the faculties. Now this is the answer given by Uttara Manavaka, the young Uttara. So then Buddha made a kind of a critic, telling that if that is the case, then all the people who are blind and deaf should be well-developed faculties, should have well-developed faculties, because they are not using their eyes, not using their ears. So then actually Uttara didn't have any answer. So at that time Buddha made a kind of a hint that this is different. I mean, this is not the real Indriya Bhavana or the development of the faculties. And in his dispensation, in the Buddha's dispensation, there is much noble explanation, method is available for development of the faculties. And at that time, Venerable Ananda was close by, and he immediately invited the Buddha to give a discourse about this, the development of the faculties. And then Buddha actually divided this whole process into three people, three categories of people. And he is explaining how a practitioner would use it. He is practicing, and how he is using a kind of strategies to develop these faculties. And another stage is explained for the trainee, a Sekapuggala, a noble person who is not yet an arahant but not a worldly person either, and how he is developing his faculties. And then thirdly, Buddha explained how an arahant, we can say, how he is maintaining his faculties, because his faculties are already developed, and how he is maintaining using his faculties. Now likewise, there are three levels explained in this sutta. And again, with the given similes, once when we are observing them, one can understand Buddha point out kind of a progressive development. So, and again, there are three strategies used for a typical practitioner. He is not yet a noble person, but he is a Vipassana kind of a practitioner. And for him, Buddha points out three methods. Now, when he sees a form through the eye, when there arises in him what is agreeable and what is disagreeable, and there may be a mixture of them. Suppose that you are looking at something and say your child, your son, your daughter, and then there is a kind of agreeable feeling arise in your mind. So you become delighted. So assume that you have seen him for a long time, after a long time, maybe your friend you have seen after a long time, so you are becoming somewhat delighted in it. So as a result of that, your mind start to talk, inner chatter start to begin, and all the past memories start to popping up to the mind, and all the various images start to fill the space of the mind. So likewise, many reactions going to build as you become delighted in this process. And on the other hand, assume that you have seen someone whom you don't like to see. On the same situation, such situation, you become unhappy and all the past incidents come to the mind, what he did and how you got hurt and what are the sort of problems, issues, quarrels you had with him. So likewise, all the past information going to cover up the mind. So likewise, this kind of a mixture also can happen. At the beginning, probably you become somewhat happy, and then again you later feel, okay, he did something wrong, are you also not that happy at that time? So likewise, kind of a mixture also can happen. So this all three states are in a way kind of agitated states of the mind. Now, why are we telling like that? So typically the mind is capable of staying calm. Now this is quite relevant to a person who has practiced Satipatthana. So when he practiced Satipatthana, he is capable of having a very calm mind. And he may be observing, suppose, various feelings. And those feelings are arising and passing away. And he is able to watch them, observe them. As a result of that, his mindfulness and clear comprehension also improves. So as a result of that, the wisdom also improving. Now, there may be a stage where you can actually distinguish pleasurable feelings, painful feelings, equanimous feelings, but after some time of practice, and you can't even distinguish them because their behavior is very much similar. Pleasurable feelings are also quite inconstant. They are transient, arising and passing away. Painful feelings are also inconstant. They are also arising and passing away. Equanimous feelings are also inconstant. They are also arising and passing away. So they all show the same picture. So show the same behavior. As a result of that you feel everything like a flux. So different feelings are there, but you can't distinguish them. Something is there, some kind of a vibration, some kind of a single tone or monotone feelings you can't distinguish. They are quickly arising and passing. Everything happens like a flux. Now you become disenchanted about this sort of a process, and ultimately mind start to let it go and mind start to become free. Now you are recognizing a state of mind which is not grasping anything, not associating anything. It does not associate any pleasurable feeling, it does not associate any painful feeling, and it is aware of some sort of a neutral feeling, and to that also he is not bound to, he is not attached to. So this is a kind of a freedom of mind actually a practitioner may experience. So when such freedom of mind is available, so one may recognize it, and there are enough instructions given to recognize it and to appreciate it, to dwell in such kind of an equanimous, unattached, unassociated, spacious, neutral kind of a state. And so one start to further familiarized with such dwelling. More and more he is able to maintain such state during the sitting, and more he is capable of maintaining such state in walking. So likewise now he is maximizing it. So he is now capable of keeping his mind unattached, not associated with anything, not burdened, and his mind is getting clearer and clearer, and he is experiencing some calmness, peacefulness, less agitation. So this peaceful state, then one becomes quite familiar with, and one is able to maintain one's mind quite often. Suppose when one is trying to do like this, suppose that again he has seen something, but that sight was so interesting, so immediately mind start to lose that equilibrium and it jump back to the delighted state. Now mind has again shifted its orientation. It was very much like on the baseline. The baseline is that equanimous equilibrium, but now it has lost that equilibrium, again it become delighted. Now Buddha is addressing here in this Indriya Bhavana Sutta for this kind of scenario. So when one's mind become agitated, either to the positive side or to the negative side. So when you see something beautiful, so it's quite possible your mind get switch or shift to the positive side. Again one become delighted. So again mind got grasped, mind get attached, mind become sort of hooked up with that whatever the beautiful sight. Now on the other hand, if you see something not beautiful, something unattractive, on that side again mind become depressed, unhappy, so again mind become somewhat tensed. So that's the negative side. Now if you are experiencing the both, then your mind start to fluctuate between the positive and the negative. So likewise the agitation starts in the mind. So that agitation has to be recognized. So how to overcome this agitation? So this is the answer that Buddha is giving here, addressing this point here in the Indriya Bhavana Sutta. And Buddha asks us to recognize, so that new state, that new agitated state is conditioned, is gross, and it is dependently arisen. So these are the three methods explained in this sutta for a typical practitioner. He is not yet a noble person. He is diligently practicing. So basically now he is very much practicing the citta anupassana, dhamma anupassana, where one is capable of recognizing the state of the mind. And due to some sort of a vision, he has seen something through his eyes. So due to that vision, his mind become agitated, either delighted or depressed. So because of this agitation, now Buddha say, so recognize this agitation as something conditioned, sankhatang. So here sankhata means that you have constructed it. Your mind was in a very simplified, very kind of equilibrium, equipoise, and quite spacious. No inner chatter, no tension, no stress. So your mind was on such situation. But now you made something, you constructed something out of that. So once you started to construct, then only your mind become agitated. Say for example, you see someone. So at the very early stage, you even didn't recognize him. And that is a kind of a color, kind of a sign. So this sign has generated some feeling, and now you want to further recognize, because this feeling is kind of pleasurable. Now you are further recognizing more and more subtle aspects. And now you are recognizing, okay, he is my son, he is my daughter, he is my friend. So likewise, now you have given a name, now you have sort of mapped your current experience with some past experience, now you are able to do this mapping. After that, the past memories start to popping up. Now you start to think, and that what we discuss in the Madhupindika Sutta now apply here. Now you start to think. As a result of this thinking, now mind become agitated. Now you have lost that equilibrium. Now you have lost that middle range or comfortable zone. And now you are in agitated mood. Similarly, you can recognize how it may happen to a unhappy situation or a painful situation where you are recognizing someone which you don't like, and as a result of that you become upset and your mind become depressed, and that also you can understand. Now, in order to happen that, you did some sort of a construction. You are the one participated in that process. You are the ones constructed. You are the one remembered all the past incidents. So you are the one sort of triggered those thinking patterns. Now this construction Buddha asks us to look at. So it is in a way kind of a wise reflection, yoniso manasikara, where you go back and look at. Go back in the sense, now your mind is agitated. Now you should step back, go out of that agitated state of mind and should look at it objectively. So this is exactly what we talk in the Chittanupassana. When there is lustful thought, you should step back, you have to go out of that lustful thought, and then you have to look at lustful thought objectively. When the mind becomes angry, so rather than you identify with that anger, you step back and look at anger as anger, objectively. Similarly, here also, now the mind has become agitated and you should go out of that agitation, step back from that agitation, and you are looking at agitation as agitation. That excited state as excited state. Now you are mindfully looking at it. And once you are able to get that perspective, now you can sort of find out how it has happened, how you have participated, how you have added various your likes and dislikes, how you have weaved that whole net. So we are the ones actually who have sort of woven this net. So this whole weaving part, how we have added from the past, from the future, from the present, all the various memories, so how we have added, and ultimately it becomes the ultimately it causes to generate an agitated state in the mind. So you are very much like looking back, you are going to the source, how this whole process has caught up its genesis. So in order to do that, the Madhupindika Sutta is very interesting, very important, because you know the technique. So this is how Buddha explained, this is how Venerable Mahakacchana has explained. And you too can now recognize it. So the constructed form. And very much similar is the dependently arisen form. So you understand, you give another perspective. That is, you understand this is a kind of a causal process. Like Venerable Mahakacchana explained in the second part in his explanation. When there is I, when there is form, I consciousness arises. When all these three are there, the contact arises. When contact is there, the feeling arises. Feeling is there, perception arises. So it's again kind of a causal reaction. So you can look at it in that angle as well. So you are finding out how each and every component contributed to the next component. That contributed to the next component. So likewise, like a chain reaction, it happens. So that is where the third method Buddha mentioned, that you have to look at this new agitated state, how it has dependently arisen. The middle method Buddha mentioned is the gross. This agitated state compared to the previous state is quite gross. It's kind of a burden. Because your mind was in an unassociated, very clean, very light, quite simple or simplified, unattached, unburdened, very pure state of mind. That is where you were before you see this sight. But now you are in a agitated, somewhat say grumpy, somewhat heavy, burdened kind of a state. So that is comparatively quite gross. So when you understand this gross nature, why are you be here now? You should go back. So that is the encouragement Buddha is given. So once you recognize these disadvantages in a way, so it is gross, it is heavy, it is agitated, it is dependently arisen, it is conditioned. Now you are understanding all these kind of consequences of this present agitated state of mind. Now the invitation is to go back, return back to that equanimous, peaceful, clear state of mind. So Buddha mentioned, one is requested to understand that previous state is much better. Previous unagitated state is much better. Etan santang, etan panitang, yaddang upekkha. So Buddha mentioned that it is the previous state, that unagitated state, is more sublime, more simplified, more equanimous. So better be there, better go back to there. So that is the encouragement given in this method. Now, when one start to practice like this, for him it may take some time to return. Doesn't matter. So you can't immediately return back to that equanimous state. But as you continue this practice, you become somewhat efficient in this whole process. You become quick, you'll be able to quickly apply the whole thing. We skillfully apply that method, and as a result of that, you can quickly again regain that equanimous state, balance state, equilibrium, kind of baseline. You are able to quickly calm down. It's very much like a shock absorber. So you are quickly able to absorb the shock and again calm down. Again, return back to that normal state, ordinary state, unagitated state, unbounded state, calm state. So this returning process become quite a quick as you continue your practice. Suppose at the beginning it took say 5 minutes to return back. Now with the continuous practice, it become 4 minutes. It become 3 minutes. It become 2 minutes. It become 1 minute. So likewise, the returning process gets less and less time, because you know how to do it. You quickly return back to that equanimous state. And Buddha give a very interesting simile here. The able practitioner, quite efficient practitioner, can quickly return back to that normal state with the kind of like you open your eye and close your eye, blink of an eye. So that is the so quickly one can, with such quickly one can return back to that unagitated state. So that is the simile Buddha giving here. When he explained about the eye, so similarly the same process can happen to ears. So when he hear a sound, the same agitation, same process what we have explained with respect to eye can happen with respect to ears as well. Due to sounds, you become agitated. So there also you can understand it is conditioned, it is gross, it is dependently arisen. Actually, you don't need to apply all three methods. If one when you are applying one method, if you are able to return back to that equanimous state, then the task is done. So Buddha has given three methods here. Whatever the method interesting to you, whatever the method which is quickly coming to your mind, you can apply and return back to that equanimous state. And for the ears, Buddha mentioned, like a strong man with a easily he does kind of a snap of his finger. Such quickly you are able to return back to that unagitated state. So similarly, Buddha explained for the smells, because of a smell on odor, that one's mind become agitated, and he is not staying there. He understand it is conditioned nature, dependently arisen nature, gross nature, and return back to the calm, equanimous state. And how quickly, like when you are dropping a rain, when raindrop happens onto a slightly sloping lotus leaf, it is quickly slips it away. It doesn't remain there. So similarly, Buddha mentioned one is able to return back to that unagitated state. So when you are going through some tests, so there also the agitation can happen. So that also Buddha mentioned, don't stay there, don't stay in that agitation. Recognize it as conditioned, gross, and dependently arisen, and return back to that unagitated state. How quickly one can do it? So he has given a kind of a reference, and that is like one easily spit out a ball of spittle. So that quickly one is able to return back. So this is, I mean, these references, benchmarks are quite interesting. So it gives some practical aspect, because at the beginning we may not be able to do it like that, because we may start to dwell in that agitation. We might find some interesting aspects in this agitation because of our ignorance. So we are not willing to go back. We are not willing to return back to that unagitated state, because we are fond of mental proliferation. We are attached to the mental proliferation. We are somewhat victimized to mental proliferation. In such situation, we are not returning back quickly. But on the other hand, if we are wise, if we are mindful, if we remember this Buddha's teaching, then it encourages us to return back as quickly as possible. So similarly, Buddha mentioned when you go through some tactile sensation, some tangible, that also can cause agitation in the mind. So there also you have to return back to that unagitated state. And there Buddha mentioned the reference, like a strong person extend his flexed arm or flex his extended arm. So very quickly, quite easily. So all these examples shows that how easy one can do it. How easy one can spit out, how easy one can blink one's eye, how easy one can flex his arm, or expanded arm get flexed. So likewise, I mean, these are very practical examples Buddha given here in this Indriya Bhavana Sutta. Now, with respect to mind, so there are also, to the mind, there may be kind of a mental object happen. So kind of a memory arise in the mind, kind of a sign arising in the mind. So you now recognize there is a sign. So you don't stop there, that's a problem. So we don't stop there. So we add some value to it. Oh, this is my mother. Oh, this is my father. This is my country. This is so and so. So you attribute some name, some value, some label to that mental object. Now, once you do that attribution, now you are adding more and more value, you are recognizing it, you are adding another stream of thought, adding another stream of thought. So ultimately, we end up with conceptual proliferation. Now, here Buddha mentioned, whenever your mind becomes agitated because of this mental object, the process has happened with respect to the mind itself. There is no participation of eye, no ear, no tongue, body. But at the present moment, it has because of a mental object. That mental object may be has a relationship with what you have seen, but that is related to the past. Currently, not because of your eye, but due to some memory. It has come as a memory to the mind. Now you have given some value to it, you recognize it, you become delighted in it, and you become somewhat agitated because of that proliferation. So Buddha asks us to recognize it and return back to the unagitated state. There also he is giving a simile. He mentioned there is a kind of a very hot iron plate, and to which one is dropping few drops of water, and quickly it evaporates. It doesn't take even a second to evaporate because it's a red hot iron plate. And one is simply putting few drops of water and it quickly evaporates. So similarly, Buddha mentioned, if one's mind get agitated, return back to that unagitated state quite quickly. Here also the simile or reference is given. So we can understand, so how the teachings of the Madhupindika Sutta we can apply here in this sutta, in the Indriya Bhavana Sutta, when Buddha is explaining how to return back to that unagitated state. When you are recognizing the dependently arisen nature of this process, when you are recognizing the conditioned nature of this process, there you can apply Madhupindika Sutta. So with that, I like to conclude today's sutta teaching session. We can discuss the other parts of this Indriya Bhavana Sutta on next week. Now I like to open the session for questions.
If we have any new friends that's joining us for the first time, welcome. And also, if you have any questions, you may raise your hand. Or you can also send them to me in the chat.
No questions today, Jennifer. Yeah. Interesting.
I think we just give everyone maybe a moment to collect their thoughts from everything that they've learned. Okay, so I'd like to invite Chita to please ask the question.
Yes, thank you very much. Well, thank you for that very beautiful explanation. What really, from a very practical point of view, is that if somebody, you know, I mean, in real life, you have these things happening. People come and say something nasty, or presents in a very ugly way. If we just try to be peaceful and calm, and invariably we shouldn't be reacting or saying anything, then in the real life, in the worldly life, people then take you for an idiot and try to make use of you. So that is a very practical thing that happens. It happens. I mean, we have also as Buddhists applied these things, but I would like you to sort of take that up a little bit more, Bhante.
Yeah, that is very true, because sometimes people think that we are kind of idiots, kind of stupid, that's why we are not saying anything, we are not reacting, something like that, so they can think. But it is up to us actually, either to react wisely, either to say something wisely, or not to react. So it's a kind of a choice now we have. Now previously, when we are not developing mindfulness, we are not developing Buddha's teaching, so we didn't have such a choice. We impulsively react whenever someone say blame. So we impulsively react. We start to blame. We start to quarrel. So that is the kind of an immediate reaction we have. But now we have a kind of a choice. So instead of immediately impulsively reacting, so we can step back and look at the process. We can look at, actually can see whether is it really true that what he is telling. Is it really that I did a mistake? Or is he sort of misunderstood my situation? He didn't really understand what has happened. It is someone else's mistake. He is blaming to me for someone else's mistake. So likewise, I mean, when the mind is not agitated, so we have that skill to look at the process or look at the situation much better. With a kind of an unbiased manner, we can look at it. So otherwise what happens is we also become quite impulsive and we also get into arguments, quarrels, and there is no end. So things become worse. But here, with the application of the Buddha's teaching, we are in a better position to understand situation in many different ways. There we can get a proper decision. So either to react here, because you know, when the other person is extremely agitated, when he is extremely, say, angry, even if we are telling the truth, he might not accept. Because he is extremely angry. So then we need to understand, okay, he is not in a mood to understand what I am telling. He is not in a mood to, say, accept what I am telling. So let him calm down. Let him sort of release his pressure. So I can be patient. So later, once he is calmed down, then I can, okay, explain, okay, this is not what has happened. This is someone else's mistake. It's not my mistake. So you can handle it properly. You can handle it so that other person then later become ashamed that why he blame like that. So he become shameful of his own reaction. So this is why, I mean, there are many, many suttas or many verses even Buddha explained this. Now there is a interesting verse in Dhammapada. Sache neresi attanam kanso upahato yatha. Esa patto sinibbanam sarambho tena vijjati. So there Buddha mentioned, like a broken gong, you know, when you are hitting to a gong, so it vibrates, it gives a echoing sound. But if it is broken, then there is no such echoing sound, it simply stops there. So someone hits and that it doesn't echoing, it simply stops. So likewise, Buddha mentioned, if you are able to stop your reaction, if you are able to impulsively avoid impulsive reaction, then you are a person who is dwelling in Nibbana. So he hasn't actually related to something less. He has related to the Nibbana itself. He is telling you are like a person who is dwelling in Nibbana. Because you are not contributing that impulsive situation. You are not contributing to someone else's agitation. So this is where I think it is quite interesting. So we now have a kind of a choice, better option. And either it is suitable, then we can react, we can give an answer, respond, or otherwise we can simply calm down.
Yes, Bhante. So I think we are obviously better off from a state of equanimity than agitation, obviously. And so we can deal with the situation in a positive way, whether at that time or later. But I think in the worldly sense, we do have to very often deal with situations.
Yes, yes.
You can't just walk away. You know, then it is detrimental to the person.
No, that's what I am trying to tell. So when you understand now at this situation, I have to do something. It is not somewhere kind of a situation, okay, I have to turn back. Rather, I need to help someone, or I need to tell something, I have to instruct someone. So likewise, assume that you understand, this is a place that I need to do something. So at that time also, if your mind is agitated, then what you are doing is not the best thing to do.
Yes.
Because your mind is somewhat perverted, your mind is not clear.
Yes.
But when you have a balanced mind, when you have an equanimous mind, then you have a better chance of understanding a better decision,
yes.
Understanding a better approach, because your mind is not restricted. And you can see various aspects of the situation and what would be the best solution for this situation.
Yes, Bhante,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I have a question about a recent Bhavana experience.
Yeah.
So I was trying to do Vipassana on the body, Kaya Vipassana, and it was a strange experience where I couldn't feel the bodily sensation. And then I really tried to go back to the body, and then I felt the sensation, the bodily sensation, for a little bit of time. But very quickly, the mind kind of went into this I'm not quite sure what exactly the mind is focused on. I just know it's kind of in front, a little bit kind of below, maybe around the, I want to say maybe around the chest area, but in the front. And the mind just stayed there. It was very clear. It was bright, but I couldn't, I didn't know what the mind was being mindful of. If that makes sense.
Yeah, correct. So basically, so when you can't recognize any kind of a bodily phenomena, I mean, you don't need to sort of put too much effort to understand it either, because you were able to understand various bodily phenomena and you were observing them and they started to fade away, and now mind has nothing. So mind is not grasping anything. Mind is not paying much attention to anything. On such situation, you can let the mind relax. Because you know, so at the beginning, we purposely do something. We purposely use the concentrated mind to watch various bodily phenomena. So that has to do. So once, as a result of that such practice, now later, mind becomes disinterested about this process. Because everything very much like becoming a flux, so it is not interesting. So mind simply give it up, leave it aside, let it go. So at that moment, we should not deliberately take another object to reflect. Rather, we have to keep the mind quiet. We have to keep the mind in a relaxed situation, doing nothing basically. So hope you got the point.
Yes, okay. But I want to confirm that, you know, I'm still practicing mindfulness and that I'm not in maybe a state of samadhi.
Definitely, definitely. I'm also not talking about samadhi. So we were practicing mindfulness, we were observing various bodily phenomena, we are quite mindful about them. And there is a state, so all these phenomena start to fade away. Now there is nothing to watch. So now it's very much like, I mean, it has certain qualities of samadhi, of course, because mind has not agitated, mind has found its kind of a unification, kind of a calmness. Actually, you have to develop it to the level of samadhi, no harm. And later only you have to use that samadhi for the development of the vipassana. But at the beginning, I mean, We need to recognize this state, we need to appreciate this state, and also we have to develop it at least to 30-45 minutes. So then only we are getting familiar with this situation.
Okay.
At the beginning it might appear like little boring, because there is nothing to do. And you may have various doubts, I mean, why should I do? I mean, there's nothing to do, everything now have gone. I mean, I feel bored. So you may have those various doubts, and then what you do is you may get up and go to walk, and you may find out another object to reflect. So likewise, this is where actually we get misled. So if we know we did proper practice, if we know that we went through good practice and we understood that how things are impermanent and how they are vulnerable and how they are non-governable and not self, and as a result of such wisdom the mind starts to let go of things, not interested in things, and when such situation happens in the mind, so we have to keep the mind quiet, keep the mind unagitated, unburdened and not associated, not hold into anything. And that state is unfortunately appear like quite boring, quite lazy. But only at the beginning you feel like that. And later, more and more you familiarize with that state, so you start to appreciate that state.
Yeah, no, I found this to be very peaceful. In fact, it felt more of an agitation when I tried to bring the mind back to the body. So I just kind of let it be, and I was that stay for about an hour. So as we continue our practice someday, this occurrence starts to happen more and more regularly.
Yes, definitely. It may happen regularly, and again it may happen quickly. Suppose now it took 1 hour to happen, and as you continue, it may happen within 40 minutes. Later it may happen within 30 minutes. And similarly, it may start to stay longer time. And that is how it is developing, and it is an improvement. And I mean, our mind become calm, quiet, unagitated. And if you purposely again put your mind back to the body, then you become restless. So we should not do that. That's what I am telling. So it's a kind of a progressive improvement that we understand. So at the beginning, we do kind of reflection, observation, and we understand the impermanent nature, transient nature, the insubstantial nature of things. And as a result of that, mind become disinterested. And as a result of that, mind start to let it go, and now mind become, you know, something like stable and not hold into anything, not attached to anything. And at that time, we should not purposely put again the mind to something else. So we have to let it be. We have to let it relax, not doing anything. Sorry, can you repeat the question? Actually, I'm experiencing some rain, so I couldn't hear you.
Oh, sorry, Bhante. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
I have a question about thoughts. Like, you just go through your day and all of a sudden a thought comes to your mind. So that's like a... according to the sutta today, you tell us to remove the thought as soon as it pops up to your mind. But I've noticed sometimes sometimes thoughts come up with things that happened in the past, and if I let it play out a bit, it almost seems like the thought plays out for a little while, and then an insight or something arises as, this is the reason why that happened, or almost like wisdom from something that happened in the past pops up. So I'm just wondering, how do you differentiate between a thought that becomes discursive thought versus a thought that comes up and you actually learn something from it. How would you differentiate that? And based on that, how do you know, like, as soon as the thought pops up, should I let it run for a little while or should I just stop it and just go back to the breath? Yeah, actually, that we have to decide depending on the situation. Set example, you have to do something useful.
Say you are given a kind of a task to do. So at that time, probably you have to look at in many different angles to how to implement this, what is the best method. So at that time, different thoughts are available. And so that may be useful thinking. You are used, I mean, things are happening under your control, and the mind is thinking and reflecting about many possibilities available. And now you select the best possibility. But it is happening under your control. That is the most important thing. So what I am trying to tell is not that we should completely stop thinking or completely avoid thinking. Rather, what I am trying to highlight here is that when you need to think, you can think, which is also under your control. And when you don't need to think, you can keep the mind quiet. So that is why what mentioned in the Vitakka Santhana Sutta, where a person is there when he likes or when he needs, he thinks. When it is required, when it is necessary, when there is an advantage, when there is a benefit. But when there is no such benefit, he simply keeps his mind quiet. So this is what we need to find out here. So typically what happens is our mind is sort of tuned to think, either it is useful or not useful, even harmful, mind keep on thinking. So that is where we have to apply brake,
That is where we need to calm down the mind and keep it quiet. So that we have to decide. Now we have to decide, okay, is this the time to think, or is it the time to calm down? Is it a useful thought, or is it a harmful thought? Suppose if it's a kind of something that you want to delete from your mind, to remove from your mind. You know that you have some past experience. If you are continuously thinking on that line, so you become agitated, you become emotional, you become upset. So you understand, I mean, no point of thinking like this. This is a wrong way of thinking. I mean, suppose that someone has passed away and you spend many hours, many days thinking about him, and you couldn't find any solution because he has gone already. There is no solution right now. Even though you spend many years thinking, there is no purpose. Now you understand there is no point of continuously thinking on him right now. He has completely passed away. Now it's a matter of finding out to how to step back, how to stay quiet, how to keep the mind unagitated, how to again regain my skills, how to return back to my normal life. So that is the constructive way of thinking. So likewise, and once you understood that, even then still those thoughts may popping up, those past memories, how you spent time with him. But now you are not encouraging it, because you know there is no benefit either to you or to him by this way of thinking. Now you know it very well, so you are discouraging it. So you understand no point of again and again thinking in this line. So at the very early stage, you are recognizing such motivation in the mind, but you recognize it and you understand its harmful nature, and as a result of that, you are discouraging it. So that we need to decide actually. Back to you, Jennifer.
Yeah, actually that's the last, oh wait, never mind, we've got one more. I'd like to invite Sutta to please ask the question.
Hello, Bhante.
Yes.
This is my first time joining this session, so I'd like to thank you for sharing your insight. And I'd like to ask, what are some ways to quickly divert one's mind from thoughts of lust in daily life? And are there any particular negative aspects of lust one should contemplate on when it arises? So I think it would be nice to be able to drop those thoughts as quickly as the sutta described. Thank you.
So, I mean, if I understood the question properly, so you are asking, so what are the negative aspects of thinking, or can you elaborate it a little?
Well, particularly like thoughts of lust, when let's see, I see somebody beautiful, and then I start having all those like thoughts of
correct. So that's why, I mean, so we all have those experiences. So say for example, when I see some beautiful woman, say, so the initial sort of feeling may be a pleasurable feeling. So that is the triggering happens. Actually, I mean, so it is a common thing. So when I and that form comes together, the eye consciousness arise, and then the feeling is a positive feeling. Feeling is a pleasurable feeling. Now I want to look at further. I want to see her better. Now I am purposely looking at her. Previously, I accidentally looked at her, but now I am purposely looking at her. Now, this is how we are participating into the picture. And ultimately, what happens, now I am going to various fantasies and, you know, various mental proliferation. Now, we all have that experience. So, similarly, when you see someone which you don't like, so assume that you accidentally saw him at the beginning. But it has triggered out some sort of a painful feeling in your mind. Now you look at him further, and you want to either try to get rid of him, and you are, even though you even turn your head away, you still start to get various memories with respect to him, what caused you say, kind of unhappy in a past situation. So likewise, so all this triggering happens inside, and if we allow that thought or that thinking to develop, then ultimately we are the ones going to suffer. So that is what we learn through Madhupindika Sutta. So what it mentioned is that if we encourage that harmful thinking, it is harmful to myself, and if it is not being controlled, then it even harmful to another person. Because suppose that you saw someone and he is a kind of a not a good person, and you become agitated, you become unhappy, you become angry, and you may start to blame, you start to cry, you start to shout, and you both start to quarrel. So that is how Buddha mentioned, I mean, all these different unskillful, harmful states going to arise. But the opposite is what Buddha recommends. So are you in a position to calm down yourself? It is true that mind has become agitated. Now you mindfully recognize that agitated state. Okay, I have lost my temperament. I have lost my calmness. Again, mind has become agitated. So it is a harmful state. It is harmful to me. It is harmful to another person. Again, I am now prone to get angry. I am prone to get on to a quarrel, argument. So you give a sign, kind of a warning to yourself. So I should not go into that such a kind of a situation. So likewise, more and more we develop mindfulness, so we are able to understand this process at its early stages. So with weak mindfulness, we can't do it. With weak mindfulness, actually, we may recognize it only when we participated into the situation. We are regretting about what has happened. But later, as we continue the practice, so start to recognize the burning mind. But still, we are not going to react. We are not going to an argument, not going to a quarrel. We can at least stop at the level of burning. But later, as we continue the practice, we don't come to even to the burning state, but we understand the very inception of the thoughts, very early stages of this process. As a result of that, we can quickly calm down. So that is why the kind of a progressive development is there. Now the Buddha has given various the best references. Say for example, when you see through your eyes, if mind become agitated and you are going back to that unagitated state like a blink of an eye. So that is the best option or the best scenario. But at the beginning we can't do that quickly. But as we continue the practice, so we are able to sort of achieve such a situation. So that is why it's a kind of progressive development, because more and more the mind dwells in that unagitated state. More and more mind associates kind of a peaceful state. So then even the slightest distraction, even the slightest shift from this baseline, you start to feel. So you start, I mean, now I have lost the baseline. I have lost my equilibrium. Because equilibrium is more peaceful. It is the least friction time, least friction zone. Now due to some triggering coming through eye, ear, nose, tongue, mind, so due to some kind of a trigger, impulse, again mind has become agitated. Now you are able to understand that very quickly as you progress.
Okay, thank you, Bhante. So if I understand you correctly, it actually doesn't really make the difference of what kind of feeling it is, if it's aversion or lust, if it's a positive feeling or negative, as long as it makes you agitated, you should recognize it as soon as possible and go back to that peaceful state. Is that correct?
Exactly. Because, you know, this either lustful or anger are the two extremes. When we attach to someone thinking that he is beautiful, she is beautiful, so that is the attachment side. On the other hand, when we are becoming angry, he is a nasty person, he's a bad person, so that is the other extreme. So the more fruitful is to be in the middle. That is where Buddha encouraged us, even in this Indriya Bhavana Sutta, etam santam, etam panitam, yadam upekkha. This is peaceful, this is calm, this is sublime. That is the equilibrium, that is the equanimous, unassociated, calm state.
Thank you, Bhante.
Yeah, yeah, welcome.
Thank you, Bhante. I believe that's all the questions we have for today.
Okay, yeah, fine. So, thank you very much for all your participation. Then we can wind up the session. And by going through this Sutta teaching session and participation into the discussion, we have accumulated a lot of merits, and we will share these merits with the traditional verses. Etta vataca amhehi sambhatam punya sampadam. Sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampatti siddhiya. Etta vataca amhehi sambhatam punya sampadam. Sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampatti siddhiya. Etta vataca amhehi sambhatam punya sampadam. Sabbe satta anumodantu sabba sampatti siddhiya. Akasattha ca bummattha deva naga mahiddika. Punyantang anumoditva chirang rakkantu sasanam. Akasattha ca bummattha deva naga mahiddika. Punyantang anumoditva chirang rakkantu desanam. Akasattha ca bummattha deva naga mahiddika. Punyantang anumoditva chirang rakkantu mamparang. Idam vo nyati nam hotu sukita huntu nyatayo. Idam vo nyati nam hotu sukita huntu nyatayo. Idam vo nyati nam hotu sukita huntu nyatayo. Imina punya kammena mame bala samagamo. Satang samagamo hotu yava nibbana pattiya. Imina punya kammena mame bala samagamo. Satang samagamo hotu yava nibbana pattiya. Imina punya kammena mame bala samagamo. Satang samagamo hotu yava nibbana pattiya. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.